You call that radio?
You call that Radio's Audio Podcast, Season 10, Episode 4, sorry, Season 4, Episode 10. It's Confessions of a Teenage Fraudster with Elliot Castro, a guy who I knew as a DJ for many, many years, but I watched his documentary on iPlayer, and it turns out that he was evading multiple police departments in multiple countries as he lived a jet-set lifestyle, flying first class all over the world and going to five-star hotels and buying fancy watches. All the while, he was skint and unemployed. It's an incredible tale, the tale of Elliot Castro. And he came on the show to talk about his documentary, talk about his book, and just tell me the incredible backstory, which I wasn't aware of, despite knowing him for 15 years. But yeah, what a show we've got for you today. I hope you enjoy it. I just want to do a quick apology for anyone that listens to the audio podcast. I put out the Mary Kiani interview last week, this earlier on this week, and I put out an interview from January 2021. So apologies if I confused anyone by thinking that they'd accidentally sat in a time machine and went back to January 2021, which wasn't a good time to go back to for most of us. So yeah, I accidentally uploaded the wrong audio. It was called The Pub Choir. I've replaced the audio. It should now be called The New Pub Choir for the Rave Generation. And that is the up-to-date interview from just last week. So if you were confused or you've missed that, then go and check it out. Mary Kiani is an amazing crack. She's the iconic voice of 90s dance music, and she's still absolutely smashing it. And she's doing a fundraiser at the Clutha on the 7th of August to raise money for Carlton Studios in Barnley, who needs our help. And he was always first to help other people in the scene. So let's just get him a good turnout on the 7th of August. And you can join Mary Kiani's pub choir, and there's an amazing lineup of musicians as well. So come along at the Clutha on the 7th of August and support that. And yeah, after this interview, go back and listen to the interview with Mary Kiani or any of the other episodes. Thank you for listening to the audio podcast. We're kind of doing it quite well now. It's every Sunday we're dropping a new one, and we even threw a bonus one in this week as well. Next week, we've got one of my musical heroes, Grasshopper from Mercurev, who have been one of my favourite bands since I was about 14. So it was an absolute honour to speak to him. That's going to be on next Sunday. So in the meantime, enjoy Confessions of a Teenage Fraudster. What an incredible tale from Elliot Castro. And this interview will not be interrupted by any sponsors or adverts or funding, because we have no sponsors or funding or adverts. So thank you to the patrons for making that happen. If you enjoy the show, go to patreon.com/ you call that radio. And can I just make one other point? This, the audio was a bit funny because this was the last time that I did an interview with a dodgy microphone. So I apologise for the audio quality over the last few weeks since I went to Mexico and since I've came back. I've been moving about, trying to get my equipment back up because I gave all my stuff away and now I'm getting things back again. But I've got a good microphone again. I've got a new sound card. I've got a new light for the studio. It's everything's coming together again. But Marco's done a great job of saving the audio and making it better. But as a result, my voice might sound a bit weird at times because he's done a great job of taking out the high end or whatever technical things he does to fix it. But yeah, that's why it might sound a bit weird this episode at certain points. But it's for the most part, it should be fine. And as of next week, we're going to have high quality audio only. So yeah, I hope you enjoy this episode despite a couple of sound glitches occasionally in my voice. But yeah, it's a really, really interesting interview. This is the tale of Elliot Castro.
One, two. Yo, this is Charlie Tuna from Jurassic 5 live and direct here in Glasgow, Scotland. And you call that radio?
I want to go live to Elliot Castro, who, so he's a bit weird, I did do a thing for. And I knew Elliot for, I don't know, must be 10, 15, maybe 20 years. From the clubbing scene, the party scene. And I just knew Elliot as a DJ. And I think maybe over lockdown, was an advice documentary or something, maybe a short thing.
he can maybe correct me in that in a second. And I heard a bit about, but it wasn't until I watched the new show, Confessions of a Teenage Fraudster, on iPlayer a couple of weeks ago, that I realised the full backstory, how he's wanted by the law from various police departments, how he think he estimated that he owed £2.5 million, how he was technically skinned unemployed, but on first-class aeroplanes and five-star hotels, and just, you know, the story, the consequences that came with eventually being brought to justice, and all his plans for the future. It was a really interesting documentary, and then I bumped into him in a Glasgow bar the day after I watched the documentary, which was mad. So I asked him if he wanted to come on the show. He said he's up for it. So I think we can go live now to Elliot Castro. How are you doing?
How you doing, Mark?
I'm good, mate. I'm good. It's mad. I was just seeing an intro there that I literally watched the documentary, and I don't think I'd seen you in real life since probably for a couple of years anyway. And then you were there in Max's. I was like, do you want to come on the show? And you were up for it. That must have been quite a mad week for you when I bumped into you, because that's probably the first time that your stories became so mainstream. I mean, BBC One. So what was that? What was that week like for you, first of all? Just everybody watching the show, and what was supposed to feedback be like so far?
So it was, I mean, that particular week was a bit mental, because obviously it went out on, I think it was the 4th, which was a Tuesday, and then it went out again, and it was on BBC One, it was on BBC Three, and then I think BBC One put it on like straight after the Euros, like the full 3 episodes in succession. So I woke up the next morning and had like just so many messages of people. Some people I knew, some people I didn't know, some people I didn't want to know as well. So a couple of crazy messages from like women trying to chat me up and stuff. And I was just, it's been absolutely bonkers, mate. But I can truthfully say that the reaction from like pretty much every single person who's messaged me has been positive, you know. And I was kind of bit nervous about that side of things when I was thinking about whether or not to actually do the documentary, because you're putting yourself on show, you know. It's like if you don't know how it's going to go, and I think when you do something like that, there's always a danger that you're going to get some people who maybe just, you know, get something negative to say about it, which I knew that before I decided to do it. But obviously I'm very grateful that the vast overwhelming majority of people who contacted me have been very positive in what they've said.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the documentary did a good job of avoiding the salaciousness of it all. It felt like good journalism was going on. I mean, who was it that kind of put the documentary together, and how did you get involved?
So, the whole thing really started about, I would say, was it about maybe March or April time of last year? I'd had numerous messages from a researcher called Olivia, who works for the production company. And over the years, I've had so many messages of companies and producers and researchers and folk wanting to talk to me about the story and stuff. And I think really you mentioned before I came on there about the Vice thing. I mean, that was something that had come out, I think it was 2020 it came out, just I think not long after lockdown started. And that was, that for me personally, that was a bit of a shit show, because what they had agreed, or what we had agreed that they were going to do, it wasn't that at all. I mean, they basically came up to Glasgow and took a full day's filming with me, and condensed it into like 5 minutes, which just really didn't put across, I don't think anyway, didn't really put across the story very well at all. And I wasn't particularly happy with the outcome of that, but I think you learn your lessons from that. So obviously when it came to this side of things, this is why I was very, very cautious about doing it. But I have to say, I mean, to give credit to the production company, I mean, they were super persistent, like to the point where I finally agreed to go and meet them for a coffee. And, you know, I didn't agree to anything straight away. It was a kind of fairly drawn out process in terms of getting something that I was happy with, that, you know, we'd put the story across, because I was really keen for it not to be like glamorized. That wasn't the sort of angle I was looking for, you know. I think mainly I was looking for it to, you know, obviously be an entertaining story. I mean, there's no getting away from that, but also to kind of serve as, I suppose, a kind of cautionary tale of sorts, you know, because what I went through is really quite a mental story. But there's a lot of people who, at that age, could easily be drawn into something very similar. Maybe not quite the same thing, obviously, but so that was kind of my thinking on it. And obviously, what ended up happening, I was quite happy with the results.
Yeah, I mean, I've just looking. I put the post up the other day, on, I think it's Saturday, just to say that you were coming on the show. A few of my friends had already watched it, and a few were then watched it for the first time. And I think one of my regular viewers and friends, Ali Grant, made a really good comment saying, the thing that stood out for me is he didn't do what he did to impress anyone. It was kind of like a personal mission, tied up in trying to feel a sense of purpose. So he doesn't brag about what he did. The one thing he liked was genuine friends. And when he actually made some, the money was the thing that destroyed that. So yeah, I felt for him at that point. He seems like a really genuine guy, and what a story. And yeah, I think that's that kind of sort of sums up my feelings as well. And yeah, I feel like obviously there is a bit of glamour to the story, because obviously you are in first class flights and 5-star hotels, so there is a slight bit of glamour. But I think it's the documentary's quite good at bridging the gap between, then you do have those genuine consequences, and then you are shitting it, and all the things that go with it. So just for people that don't know, so let's just take away the documentary for a second. So it's called Confessions of a Teenage Fraudster. It's as we're filming this just now, we're live just now, if you're listening to the audio podcast, it should still be on BBC iPlayer. It's 2 episodes. It's really worth a watch. Get it checked out. But if we just kind of take it away from the documentary for a second and just talk about the actual story itself. So I just want to... So just a long story short, what is the documentary about? It's a true story on your life, obviously. But for someone who's not heard or seen anything about it, how would you describe it?
Okay. Well, that's not a quick question to answer, is it? I mean, I guess, like...
Give me your life story in one or two sentences.
Right, okay. I mean, yeah, the story basically is when I was about 15 or 16 years old, I was in a position where I found a credit card on a train once, and I was already kind of aware of credit cards, kind of like knew what you could do with them and stuff like that, but I just found this card and I used it on the train to buy my ticket to school. Which was the very first time that I'd done it, and basically that first time I got caught. You'd think that, you know, after that I would maybe have been put off, but I think what happened, like, up to a certain point, because obviously this went on, so basically from the ages of 16 to 21, roughly 21 and a half, something like that, I was involved in credit card fraud, and it just over time it just escalated in terms of value, seriousness, luxury, that sort of thing. Everything, it started off with like CDs and haircuts and just stuff that teenagers buy, basically, and ended up being, as you said a minute ago, kind of first class flights and world travel and luxury hotels, yachts, limousines, everything that, you know, you would associate with that kind of lifestyle, basically. And then over that period of time, there was several near misses where I almost got caught. There were several times when I did get caught, but it was for like something very small in relation to the bigger picture. And then in 2004, I finally got caught after just getting daft, really, and a bit silly, and not taking all the precautions that I used to. Which, you know, there's a much bigger conversation there about why that happened and what caused me to stop taking those precautions and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, in terms of just trying to keep it brief, and I know that's been a lot more than two sentences, by the way, but yeah, that's basically the story.
And a good point that you make up about is the precautions and stuff. And I suppose it's because it happened over quite a long... How long a period are we talking about here between from, say, the I think it's when you started getting serious, it's maybe the call centre, and then from there it kind of escalated on. Cause you were talking about the other stuff was like CDs and haircuts, but then when it starts becoming, you know, like booking flights and all that kind of stuff, do you think that you are Like, because obviously you were taking precautions not to get caught. But how scared were you when you were doing this stuff? Were you getting, were you terrified at the start, or were you getting an adrenaline rush? Where would you rate your fear at the beginning of these, like, flights and things, hotels?
I mean, fear level probably was quite low, to be honest, because, I mean, I'm not being funny, mate, but see, when you, like, when you're a teenager, you don't have the same level of understanding about consequences of things, you know? I mean, obviously, I think I definitely took it to extremes, there's no doubt about that, but the fear wasn't really there. I mean, I think what ended up happening throughout time was that there would be an initial sort of, like, is it going to go through? Is it not going to go through? Has she spotted something? Has she, you know, is there something, like, been worked out here? So, you know, there was always that sort of little kind of niggling whenever you were doing any kind of transaction, but particularly, like, high-value stuff, you know. I mean, the one example I remember quite clearly was I went into a bank in Belfast, and I don't think this is still a thing nowadays, but it used to be that if you had a credit card, you could go into banks, you could go to just about any bank, as long as, like, say if it was a Visa card and the Visa sign was in the window, you could go in and ask for cash as long as you had ID and stuff like that. Now, bearing in mind that a lot of the cards, the vast majority of the cards that I was in possession of were actually in my name, that helped a lot with that because it meant I could go in and ask, pass over a card. But this one day, I went into this bank in Belfast, I'm pretty sure it was either 3.5 or 5 grand that I'd asked for. And you pass over the card, your ID, and then it used to be years ago, they had these, like, they were, I can't remember the name of them, there was a name for them, the machines that went from side to side and took an imprint on the card, like, of the actual raised numbers and everything. So she did all that, and then she had to go away and phone for authorization. So she was through, like, the back bit of the office, I couldn't see her, and she was there for, like, it seemed like, it probably was only a few minutes, but in that moment, like, your heart's going absolutely pounding, like, mad, because you don't know what the outcome's going to be. Like, I was fairly confident, I was fairly confident it would be fine, otherwise I wouldn't have took the chance, but you just don't know when that call's made, what might come out the other end, you know, the other bank might go, well, hang on, let's just check a bit more about this, it's quite a lot of money, or you just don't know. And anyway, but when she came back, she had the money in her hand, and I knew it went through. And I'm channeling that feeling right now, and I'm trying not to smile too much about it. But that's how it is, you know. You've got that kind of there's the fear that's there, and then see when it's done, and you get the money or the watch or whatever the fuck it is you're trying to buy. It can be very addictive. There's no doubt about that. It's some buzz.
So obviously we're going back to the early 2000s. Do you think that back then there was just like a blind spot to people? Because obviously I think that you were quite good at portraying the character as well. So when you said a lot of the time it was in your own name as well. So was this a security feeling, or were you just very good at it, or would you say it was a bit of a mixture of both that was going on?
I would probably have to say it was a mixture of both. You know, I mean, I'm not arrogant enough to say that, you know, it was all down to me being super intelligent or working this, that. I mean, you know, I think self analysis wise, there was obviously going to be a part of that. But I didn't really think about it like that. I was just like, right, here's the problem. How do I get over it? How do I get around this? How do I make sure? And then obviously as time went on, because I mean, I failed loads of times as well. You know, there's lots of times where things didn't happen the way I expected. But every time that happened, I would always take a step back and say, right, what went wrong there? How did that? Why did that not go according to plan? And how do I ensure that that doesn't happen again in the future? Which I think is a good way to look at things in life in general, you know, whether or not you think that particular use of it was appropriate, you know, it's a good way to look at things in general. So, yeah, there was always that kind of aspect to it as well. But definitely you'd asked about the banks and the security procedures. I mean, it definitely was a very, very different world back then, Mark. There's no doubt about it. One of the questions people ask me all the time is, like, could you still do it now? And the answer to that is 100% yes, absolutely. It could still be done now. It would be different and it would probably be more difficult. Well, it could still be done. It would just be a different way.
Well, there's no doubt that there was a very high level of intelligence going on. You had to think on your feet a lot of the time. Otherwise, you wouldn't have been able to do it. But with regards to... It's something that I've been forced into having a card that beeps, you know. I was saying I didn't want one of the cards that you can beep for... Well, just because I didn't want to get it forced in my throat. But now that I've got one, do you think that that's opening up a new era of people like stealing credit cards, using them, or is it because there's limits on it, it's not so bad, or what's your feelings on that now that you don't... So I'd imagine that PIN numbers would have made things a bit safer for a while, but now that you don't even need to put a PIN number in, now, has it changed things again?
Yeah, I mean, so I'll answer that in reverse order, if you don't mind, just because it makes more sense. But so you're talking about PIN numbers and how they made things safer, right? I can tell you right now, see when chip and PIN arrived, I was like that. Here we fucking go. And the reason was, right, because if you can imagine, I'm getting cards sent to me with my name on them with a PIN number. So I now no longer need to sign anything. I don't need to touch anything. There's just a number that I put in and that's it. There's no questions about signatures. There's no looking at the name on the card. There's none of that. So for me at that time, with the actual type of fraud that I was committing, that was an absolute it was like a bonus. It really was. As for the other part of your question, just, you know, regarding sort of contactless, which I think is what you were referring to there and how that works. I mean, obviously, you know, it goes without saying, if somebody drops a card in the street at this point, then there is always a chance that somebody could pick up the card and take it in a shop and spend up to £100 on it without any checks being done. But there are only a certain number of times you can do that. And obviously, you know, it goes without saying that, you know, if there's anything over £100, then you still need to put your PIN number in. Fraud is a thing that, like, see the way I always think about this is, I get asked questions like this quite often by my clients as well, right? And the truth of the matter is, Matt, see whenever somebody has something that's of value, there'll be somebody else who wants to take it from them, right? There will always be that. Because there are people in the world who that's the only way that they think they'll ever be able to achieve those things is by taking them dishonestly from someone else. And I fell into that category for a few years of my life as well. So I was one of those people that thought that was the way. But the thing about fraud is that kind of thing in general is that there's always going to be more people engaged in trying to actually do it than people who are trying to prevent it, if that makes sense. And the other thing as well is, I mean, I speak from personal experience when I say this. When I was trying to do what I was doing, like, I would literally sit in a hotel on the phone for 8 hours solid until I got what I was looking for. Sometimes I would get it straight away. Sometimes it would take a couple of hours. Sometimes I would get one, but then I would think, right, I was just not comfortable with that. I'm going to get some more. And I would literally, you know, I'd pick up the phone at 2 in the afternoon. And then before I knew it, it was like 10 o'clock at night. But I would have a notepad sitting next to me filled with information that I could then go away and use. And that's the kind of dedication that some of these people put into what they're doing. Whereas if you think about, like, a fraud prevention specialist, for example, right, they'll go to their job and they'll work 9 to 5, and that's it. When they finish their job, they go home, and that's it. But the person trying to do the fraud, their work doesn't stop until they've achieved what they're trying to achieve. So you're always going to have that. And one of the other things, just sorry to prattle on, but one of the other things as well is just like in regards of people's, I'm trying to be careful how I say this because I don't want to offend anyone, but some people are quite gullible and quite naive. But not only that, sometimes the people that are doing the fraud are really like super, super smart at how they're doing it. So you've got the combination of both of those, which is if you've got both of those together, so like a really smart fraudster and a really gullible person, then you've got a recipe for disaster. Someone's getting done, you know, and the weakest link quite often is the human being because they're the one who can be convinced that something's, you know, the way that it's been portrayed when it's not actually. For example, like say, you know, one of the biggest scams at the moment is people get phoned and told that fraudsters are trying to get into their bank account and they need to move all their money straight away or else they might lose it. Now, if you think about it, unfortunately, tends to be quite often like a lot of elderly people who are victims of those kind of scams because you know, they're maybe just not quite as quick in thinking, or they're not used to the technology, or they don't understand, you know, what's going on and all that sort of thing. And plus, they get the fear of God put into them because somebody's phoning them, telling them all this shit, and then, you know, taking like 200 grand off them, their life savings or whatever. So it is a sad fact, but it has to, you know, there's no other way of putting it, that the human being can be the weakest link in the chain at times, because they're the ones who can be convinced of things. Whereas computers, quite often, you know, if you try and get into your online banking, for example, if you don't know the right password, the right combination of letters or whatever the security procedure is for your bank, if you don't know that stuff, you ain't getting in. The computer's just going to go, no. But if you speak to a human being at the bank, well, you might be able to persuade them, because you might just be convincing enough they go, oh yeah, this person sounds genuine, I'm just going to let them in. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a good point that you made about the fear factor. So like, for example, when people phone up and say, you're being attacked by fraudster, people are going into self-defense mode. So they've got to think quick. The same thing applies to, you know, most viruses. People that get caught with a virus is usually a virus cleaner, a fake virus cleaner saying that you've got a virus. You better download this other virus cleaner in order to save it, or something like that as well. But I mean, there was things that, obviously, there's a lot of scams. I think especially sort of, I would say kind of our age group, we should be fairly switched on, because most of us have been on the internet since it practically began. So there's not really any excuses for us, but for older people, yeah. And for younger people now as well, they've maybe not seen these scams a million times happening. But there was a few things in the documentary that stood out that I can imagine that a lot of people falling for. The first one that springs to mind is when you were phoning the hotels. Could you explain to the listeners what you did to make that happen? So when you were just, you know, phoning a random hotel.
Yeah. So where that started actually was, I'll try not to be this too elongated, but basically at one point I had card details that I'd written down from when I worked at the call centre. And when those details ran out, I was in a hotel one day, and I was near the reception area, like literally just next to it, and another guest checked in. So I heard his name and I heard the room number and all the rest of it. And I don't even know where the idea came from. Literally, I can't. I mean, it must have just popped into my head at that time, because I'd never thought of it before. I went to like another sort of quieter part of the lobby area and sat down, and I took my phone out and I called the hotel from my mobile and then asked to be put through to that room. So obviously the gentleman's just arrived in the hotel, and I said to him, hi sir, it's you know, Peter here from the reception. I'm really sorry to bother you, but there's been a bit of an issue with your card. I know it's a wee bit embarrassing, but let's get this cleared up for you. I've got the bank on the phone. They've just asked us to check a couple of questions with you, if you don't mind. And the guy was like, oh, I'm so sorry. Yeah, absolutely. What do you need? So I just proceeded to ask him for all the information that I would have needed in order to access that account. So the card number, I just asked him to go over that again. Card number, expiry date, mother's maiden name, date of birth, and all the sort of usual questions that banks tend to ask as security. I literally got off the phone and I was like, fuck me, that was easy. Obviously that was a very specific set of circumstances, that one, because obviously I'd seen the guy check in, I knew he was there, he just arrived, it was all going to make sense. But where it went from there really was that kind of got me thinking about that would be a really good way to get more details, would be to contact hotels. So it went from there to contacting hotels, and then from contacting hotels to contacting luxury hotels, because I was like, well, people who stay in luxury hotels are going to have more money, so bigger credit limits and so on and so forth. And that was the technique that I used for the largest part of this whole time I was doing what I was doing.
That works on two levels, I suppose, because you've got the fear of, especially if you're on a date, looking like, especially if it's someone that's in a fancy hotel and they're maybe on a date, and then the hotel saying, here, your card's bounced, a problem with it. So you're also working on shame as well, embarrassment of looking like you don't have any money in a posh premises as well. So, yeah, you're just randomly phoning hotels and asking for a Mr. Smith, or a
yep, It always was Mr. Smith. I mean, the thing is, obviously, you know, the reason it was Mr. Smith is quite simply just because that's the most common surname in the English language. So, you know, but I mean, you'd be surprised. I mean, sometimes, unfortunately, there wasn't a Mr. Smith in the house. I say unfortunate, not for them, obviously. But yeah, so, you know, I used other names as well, just other common surnames. But Smith was the go-to.
And when you did mention earlier on about your clients, just to, before we get back into the actual the story itself, but nowadays you actually are, am I right in saying that you're sort of like anti-fraud solutions, or what would you call your role, and what kind of clients do you deal with now?
So I think if I had to put a title on it, I would say maybe a consultant, fraud or security consultant, or whatever you want to call it. What I'm very sort of fortunate to be doing nowadays is I'm approached quite often by clients who, are mostly business clients, in fact, predominantly business clients who are perhaps just wanting to ensure that their anti-fraud procedures are up to scratch. And I'll sometimes have a look at things and see if I can spot any loopholes, or just even sometimes do training sessions with their staff, their fraud staff, just to kind of try and help them understand how a fraudster might think in terms of what they might, how they might approach a situation and what the staff should be looking out for. So there's that. And then I do a lot of public speaking engagements as well. Most of those are kind of based around telling a bit about the story. And I work quite closely with all my clients to try and make sure that, you know, there's a positive message at the end of the day. So generally speaking, any client who I do work for, we would always have a sort of a consultation chat on Zoom or something first, just so I can try and understand exactly what their needs are and what the message that they want to get across to the audience is, and then we just take it from there. But it can be really interesting work sometimes, because you actually get to hear other stories about, like, other fraudsters and what they've been up to, you know, and it's you know, I've quite watched, because I feel as if I can't not be honest about this, but sometimes I just do have to say that I feel a wee bit of admiration for some of the stuff that they come up with. You know, it's not so much the outcome, and especially not if it's causing people serious problems in their life as a result, but some of the things that you hear, just absolutely, you think that's pretty genius, you know. So it gives you a lot of opportunity to hear those things as well.
And in your head, at the time, were you just thinking, because obviously, when I shared this, and the majority of people just loved it, because I think people have all had issues with banks and credit card companies, and the majority of that money would have been the insurance companies or the credit card companies who would have to fork out. Were you seeing it on that angle, that you were we were almost like a Robin Hood type character who is taking it from these big companies, or were you just so young that you just didn't really care?
Robin Hood, I don't know, Mel, Robin Bastard. But no, I mean, to answer your question, truthfully, mate, see, like, there's always going to be some people, right, who think that, you know, I'm just a scumbag because of what I've done, right? But honest to God, see, when I was doing it, I always had in the back of my head that these people would get their money back, and because they hadn't authorised any transactions at the bank, wouldn't they charge them for it? I mean, that's honestly what I thought about the whole situation. And I know, even now today, I know that is true, and that most people would have got their money back, and they wouldn't have made any financial loss or suffering. But at the same time, you know, I can't sit here in 2024 and say that I also don't understand the stress that would have put people through. And that's shite, and I do feel bad for that. But I have said it before, you know, it is difficult sometimes for me to feel sorry for banks and financial institutions when I see some of the things that they have done to people and businesses, you know, and they've gotten away with it. I'm not saying that then entitles me or anyone else to do anything like what I did. But, you know, just in terms of looking at things in the bigger picture, am I sorry for what I did? Absolutely. So if the people that suffered any sort of stress as a result of what I've done, truly, I am sorry about that. But the financial side of things is a wee bit more tricky. But the one thing I will say, sort of looking at things perhaps in a, I don't know, perhaps maybe a more spiritual way, is that I know that earning money or gaining money in the way that I did, it wasn't the way that's not how you're supposed to do it, you know. Whereas now, today in my life, like, you know, every penny that I've earned has been earned by my own graft, and it's been earned honestly. And there's a very different value to that kind of money. When I think back to when I was like 18, 19, 20 and I had this money, the truth is the things that I bought weren't really mine, because you don't value it the same. You know, you could argue that there was some graft involved in terms of the stuff I had to do, like I was talking about earlier, sitting on the phone for 8 hours, blah, 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 blah. But it's a different feeling when you're spending money that actually is yours, as opposed to spending money that, you know, has been earned dishonestly.
And I would actually say, although I was legitimately making money in call centres back in the day, but you're working for companies that are probably not honest. So even though you're doing an honest day's work, you are working for a company that probably, you know, because we're all kind of, most of us are forced to work for some sort of corporation in some level. So it's great that you've actually found an avenue whereby you can make money for helping people. And we're going to talk about one of your other ideas is to help people as well, which is great. Because it's kind of like that, you hear a lot about it in big news stories or even movies, where you get the genius hacker who goes to jail, or they then end up working with the FBI or whatever. So it's kind of, because they've got the skills that the other side don't always have. So you're coming in with some real life experience. One of my questions I wanted to ask you was what was your, well, actually two questions. What was your happiest time and what was your worst time while you were going through all of that stuff? I mean, it seemed to me that you were having a right good time in Belfast when you started becoming a DJ before the questions started coming. Would I be right in saying that, or was it maybe the first time that you went to a really fancy hotel, or what was the happy times?
I mean, I think in terms of like what was happy, happiness was at a premium at that time, if I'm totally honest with you. And this is one of the things that I do always try to explain to people when they ask me about it, you know, because if looking at it from outside, it is so easy to think, oh, this guy just had the best time of his life. And the truth of the matter is, mate, honestly, there's so many things that I did that I'm grateful I had the opportunity to do, like places I went, experiences I was able to have, you know, places I stayed, flights I took, that, you know, first class flights, and all that kind of stuff, which I totally understand that many folk will never probably get a chance to do some of those things. And that's, I can't help but feel grateful. However it came about, I can't help but feel grateful for that. But realistically, I wasn't a very happy person, and I think that's evidenced in the fact of what I was doing, because people who are truly happy within themselves would never take it upon themselves to do the sort of things that I was doing. And I know, I mean, I've done a lot of soul searching over the years, and I know that I was just absolutely desperate to be liked. That was my problem, because of, you know, experiences I had when I was at school and just always being a loner and stuff like that. So I just had this desperate urge to be liked by people. And unfortunately for me, it took me down a path which not only got me into a lot of trouble in terms of like legalities and stuff like that, but it also made me prone to having people in my life who were only around because they felt there was something I could give them. And do you know, it would be so easy to feel regret about all those things, but in all honesty, I think I learned some super valuable lessons about human nature at that time. So sorry, I know that's not the question you've asked, but I mean, in terms of like happy times, I mean, yeah, you know, I think, you know, I hadn't really thought about it so much until you mentioned it there. But yeah, Belfast actually was a time when there was an amount of happiness around. I don't know if that was, I mean, I guess partly that would have been down to the fact that for the first time in my life, I had some people around me who were genuine friends, you know. Some of it might have been down to all the partying I was doing, and we won't say any more about that. But yeah, so that, there was a lot of that. As for like the other side, the flip side, I mean, obviously, I think any jail setting probably that time would be particularly shit. But I think perhaps the very worst, I think the nadir was when I was in that jail in Canada. That was a really horrific experience, and just especially being so young. I mean, I think, you know, obviously now I'm 41, and I think, like, okay, that was like, what, 21, 22 years ago? And I was like a kid, really, you know? And you realise that more, see the older you get, when you meet people that age and you see how they are, you think, God, they're just fucking kids, really. like, you know, no disrespect, and they're still people and all the rest of it. But you think sometimes you meet folk our age and you think, so that's something like what I was like when I was that age. Right, cool. You know?
Yeah, I think we've all felt that. And it's because obviously you think you know all when you're young, don't you? And then life's just a constant learning experience. But I think it was a really good answer because, you wouldn't have been, if you were happy, you wouldn't have been doing so much stuff. But I suppose, I think it was that really nice moment where you're in Belfast and you got your first ever club gig and that was your money.
Oh,
that actually meant something to you.
That was fucking bonkers, man. So basically, what happened was a friend, it was obviously every single weekend and half the days during the week as well, as you do when you're that age. But what had happened was someone had told me this new night was on, so me and my mate went, listen, why don't we just go down? I'll take some of my tunes down and see if I can get a shot. Now, the sheer brass neck of that, I mean, I cannot imagine doing that nowadays, but it worked. I walked in and it was brilliant. Just thought, this is a cool club. Found out who the promoter was, and I just went up and spoke to the guy. I was like, listen, mate, I'm a DJ. Any chance I could play some tunes? And he was like, ah, on you go. And the place was full as well. There must have been like 200 people there or something, 200 or 300 people. And I just went, and it was like, that was the first time I played in front of a crowd like that, and it was just an incredible buzz that I'll never forget, and it stuck with me. And I'm glad it did, because actually it really gave me something to sink my teeth into when I finally got out of jail and realised that, you know, that was no longer, the life I'd previously led was something that I no longer wanted to do. It gave me a bit of an option. I'd always been into my music and my tunes and all the rest of it, so it kind of fit in nicely. And then when I did get out of jail and came back to Glasgow, I met people very quickly, actually, just through going out, and actually through a friend of my dad's as well, got introduced to someone, ended up doing some of the nights at the Soundhouse that I know you were quite fond of yourself, Mark. I mean, I think you had a show with them. Did you not do a show with Lynn or something? Like, was it last year or something?
Yeah, well, we did during lockdown with the Soundhouse sessions. Soundhouse Sunday, every Sunday during lockdown for about a month, we had Lynn hosting four episodes. I just kind of helped produce it. But that would have been probably, so when I probably bumped into you, would have been, I'm guessing maybe 2008 onwards, probably around about then. So you probably just came out of jail and just started a new life.
2005, November 2005, that was when I got out after my last spell in jail.
Yeah, I had no idea. I just knew you as a DJ. I remember you DJing at house parties. I don't know if that was Peaches or something, but we were in Manchester City. I remember you DJing, but I didn't know the backstory. But I mean, there was a fucking book. So I don't know how I missed this. But I suppose you might not have been wanting to talk about that stuff, because I can imagine that people might have had trust issues with you if that's... I mean, obviously now, I don't think that's the case, because it's like, it was 20 years ago, but at the time, did you find it quite hard to open up to people about your background? Or I've got an image of the book there, it's called Other People's Money, and that came out, everyone else said it was fascinating and illuminating. So I'll put a wee link in the comments for anybody who would quite fancies the book. So when did the book come out? And when did you start feeling okay to open up about your background in Glasgow?
So I mean, I can kind of remember actually one of the first times that I did speak about it, and it was after I came out of jail in 2005, came back to Glasgow, and I started going to an open decks night, a pub called Osmosis down at the so there was a few faces that we both know were involved at that back in the day, you know. But I started going down there, and then as a result of going to that, I was asked to DJ at the night called The Basement, which was down at the Soundhouse, as you know. And then from there, like, just ended up getting quite a lot of gigs. I ran my own night for a while, which, to be honest, it was a brilliant night, but we were off our faces half the time. And as a result of that, the night didn't really, it didn't flourish the way it should have done. Because you think when you're running a night, it's just party time, and it's actually not. You don't need to consider it as a business. But we were just, to be honest, we were just having a good time. We weren't really, as long as people turned up, which they did, then, and that was brilliant. But the club as well, with that, it's a long story, but the club fucked us over as well. So there was a lot of shit going on at that time. But yeah, so that's basically kind of how I got into DJing and stuff. And I think, sorry, just getting a bit sidetracked here, but you asked about like the first time that, or when I'd opened up about it. And I remember there was a good few people that I'd met on the party scene who, you know, we were always out at the same places every weekend. You know how it goes, everyone's always out together, blah, 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 back to parties and all the rest of it. And we were at a party at a friend's house one night, and somebody had obviously asked me a question, because I mean, it's not something I would just launch into without there being something asked of me. So somebody's obviously asked me something. I started telling them about having been in jail, and obviously, oh, what were you in jail for? And then blah, 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 blah. So everything just came out as a result of that. Actually, people were quite accepting of it, because I think they just realised that, you know, I was being candid about it, and you know, I didn't feel that I had anything to hide. You know, I did what I did, mate, and you know, there's no point in spending the rest of your life kind of beating yourself up about something that you've done. You know,
absolutely not. I mean, everybody's done absolutely stupid stuff when they're teenagers, anyway. But obviously, yours was just like you had different police departments searching you, looking for you, and it's like you were 19-year-old or 18-year-old, and you had an arch nemesis and a police constable or whatever it was. And I thought that was quite an interesting bit of the story. There was one specific guy that was trying to track you down, and I think in the end you ended up sort of striking up, well, not a friendship, but a sort of a mutual respect. Or is that right? Am I right in saying that?
I would say so. I mean, you know, like, to be honest with you, like, I know a lot of people who've been involved in crime have got absolutely nothing good to say for any cops at all. They just consider all cops to be scum of the earth and immortal anyway. But, you know, I mean, don't be wrong, I met arsehole cops my time as well. But this one cop, the reason why I say that I have a bit, unfortunately he passed away about 3 or 4 years ago, but the reason that I had a bit of mutual respect for him was because when he arrested me, I'll kind of give you a wee bit of the backstory. So I only discovered that he was chasing me when I was in jail in Canada, and I phoned the Canadian Immigration after having been sentenced to try and find out when I was going to be deported. Now, obviously, for security reasons, they wouldn't tell you that. But through that conversation, I phoned back and pretended to be the British Embassy. Sorry, I missed that one crucial point there. And when I phoned back, and I just put on a really kind of stiff upper lip sort of British accent, you know, and I said, we're just wanting to know when Mr. Castro is being deported. His family are concerned for his welfare, blah, 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 blah. And the guy was like, he just totally opened up. He says, oh, yeah, you know, he's being deported on Monday, blah, blah, blah. I said, we've been asked to inform Ralph Eastgate. And I was like, hey, okay. I was like, well, I said, like, don't worry. I said, the embassy will take care of that for you, you know. And he was like, oh, brilliant. So that was basically the first time I'd heard Ralph Eastgate's name. And obviously from there, I was then kind of in this point where I was not sure whether or not there was going to be somebody waiting to pick me up when I landed at Heathrow after being deported. Anyway, that's in the documentary, so if you watch that, you'll see. But anyway, so that was when I found out that he was after me. And how it all came about was just all these airlines were just losing the rag because I was travelling first class, like, everywhere and spending fucking fortunes on flights. And he'd basically been one of the airlines in touch with him to say, listen, you know, can you help us? This guy is absolutely rinsing us. And essentially, that was how he became involved. But it was about, I think it must have been at least out of the whole time I was doing it, he must have been chasing me for about at least three and a half, maybe even 4 years of that whole time. Obviously, you know, maybe not chasing me quite as hard at the start, but, you know, over time, once things were building up and he'd had more and more complaints about me, and then when he finally did catch up with me, I find it really hard to believe I'm saying this about a copper that arrested me, but he was absolutely brand new. You know, like, he took me down to the station, he bought me 20 fags, he bought me a book to read, he let me phone my mum, you know, he was just like, I don't know. I think in his words as well, I mean, I don't want to quote him wrongly here, but I'm sure that that's what he said. He was like, you know, because it was his last case as well. It was like this case that he'd been working on for ages, and it was his last case before he retired. So I think it was quite close to his heart. And then when he finally did catch up with me, one of the things that he said was that he walked into the cell and he walked straight back out because he was like, that's not him. That can't be him. He's too young, you know. I don't know what he was expecting, but it clearly wasn't this lanky teenager that was sitting in front of him, you know. But yeah, so as far as respect for Cobsco, I mean, I have to give props to that guy because he was old school, you know. He was like literally old school. He was ex-flying squad and all that kind of stuff, you know. But yeah, so absolutely mutual respect for that one, sure. Some of the other ones, I'm 100% definitely not. But, you know, yeah.
Well, I've got one final question and I'll maybe go to the comments. If anyone's got a question for Ellie and you're tuned in live, we're on Facebook, Twitch and YouTube just now. If anyone's got a comment, leave it in the comments. I'll try my best to read out maybe one or two. Just to clarify, is it true or false that it was an estimated 2.5 million? Is that a conservative figure or an exaggerated figure, or what do you think?
So, see, just to kind of point out, right, that figure is not a figure that I ever came up with. But having sort of looked, I remember like one day a few years ago, I sat down and I kind of tried to work out what I think I might have spent. Now, the reason it's hard is because, number one, I wasn't keeping notes. And number two, no one, like, I'm not going to be able to ask anyone else to tell me how much I stole, because obviously there's a lot of it that wasn't discovered, no doubt, and might be better off that way, I don't know. But, yeah, so it was a difficult one. I think it was a figure that was mentioned by the police at the time. I think it was either at the sentencing or sometime during that whole case. They'd said that, you know, that was roughly what they thought I may have spent. And the figure that they gave was somewhere between £1.5 and £2.5 million. But obviously what's happened over time is that whenever it's been picked up by any media outlets, obviously they want to make it as shocking as possible, so they always go up for the 2.5. But, I mean, truthfully, it may have been that. I don't know, because when you think about some of the amounts of money I was spending on an almost daily basis, I mean, we're talking about, like, you know, flights. So, you know, a transatlantic flight, London to New York, first class, at the time, it's probably more now, but at the time was about £8.5 grand. You're talking to, like, London to Tokyo, it's more. London to Sydney, it's like £15 grand, maybe something like that. So you've got all that. So flights at that kind of value, and then you've got, like, nights out where there would be bottles of champagne being purchased at, like, £1, £2, sometimes maybe even £3 grand a bottle. Hotel suites, which sometimes cost 15, 20 grand a night. And I'm not saying I would stay in those rooms for a week or anything like that, but, you know, when you're doing that every single week, it mounts up pretty quickly. As for, like, kind of material things, so tangible possessions, I mean, there was some of that, but most of the money that I spent on those kind of things was on clothes, and I didn't wear a huge amount of jewellery, but I had a few watches, and obviously some of those got taken off me, and some of them got lost, some of them got stolen, believe it or not. You know, so there was all that kind of side of things as well. But I think, you know, to sort of give a sort of final answer to you, I mean, I suppose it is entirely possible that it was £2.5 million, but it's really hard to say. It's really hard to say.
So, because obviously you get that way when someone does a drunk bust, the police tend to exaggerate things.
Aye. Street value. And every dealer's like that. What fucking street is that, by the way?
So you've got the street value. So you've got the police exaggerating, because you're obviously a big fish that they've caught, and that's probably why the guy was so happy to catch you as well. So, yeah. So they're happy, so they're exaggerating things. But then, like you said, allegedly there may have been things that they didn't catch, but we'll only talk about that too much. Farway Jen, I'm going to answer this question for you because you did miss it. She says, where does Ellie stay now and what is the day job? Sorry if it's been discussed. But yeah, we did talk about it. You want to answer that quickly?
Yeah, sure. So, in terms of what I do now, there's a large part of my days taking up with doing my consultancy work. I do some sales work as well, which is a good way for me to make money. And I've got some other stuff I'm doing just now as well, which is working with charities. Although I'm working with one or two charities anyway, which was a charity in North Lanarkshire that I've been doing a bit of work with, where they work with like young people, so they're aged like 16 to 18 in age. It was just like young people who have maybe had some difficulties in their youth and just maybe feeling a bit lost. And it's something I'm really quite passionate about because I totally understand how that feels. So I've been trying to sort of get myself into a position where I'm able to help people. And I feel that as time goes on, it's one thing that I really do feel that if there's one thing I have to do in my life, and it's not like it's 100% not because I feel like I have preparations for anything, it's because I want to do it. And the experiences that I know that there's knowledge I can help other people, that might be able to help their lives a wee bit as well. So I do all that. I've got my consultancy work. As you know, I've been on the telly and stuff like that. So there's more questions about other ideas and stuff. One of which I don't really want to say too much about just now, but it could be a very, very interesting program. That's actually what I can say to everyone.
And of course, there's also your music and your DJing and stuff as well. And off air, you were talking about, I don't know if you want to talk about how you were saying that you were another plan that you had for the future. Can we talk about that?
So that's fine. One of the things that I've been looking into is particularly like prisoners who are about to be released. And I was very fortunate when I got to jail the last time because not only did I have my parents to go back to and a loving home to go back to, but also had the benefit of writing a book, which happened very quickly after I got out of prison. So I had a lot of things to keep me busy. Added to that I'd already kind of made the decision that I didn't want to go back there, was very, very lucky for me, and I'm always grateful that that was the case. But I do understand that there's so many more people who come out of prison and they literally do not know what the fuck they're going to do with themselves. Come out of prison, they get that. I don't know how much it is they give you now, probably about 60, maybe 100 quid or something. They give you a grant when you get out. You might have to go and see a probation officer a couple of times. But from there, you're pretty much left on your own. And the other thing about people coming out of prison is that because they've now got a conviction, it's not a case of just walking in somewhere and applying for a job. They've got to give details of their convictions to any employer for a certain amount of time. And if they've been in jail for a while, then it's indefinitely. So I think one of the things I'd like to look at is what are we doing in society to help those people? Because they've done something wrong, but I thought we lived in a compassionate society where people deserve a second chance. And it's a lot of the way that we work with these things, it doesn't reflect that at all, and that quite annoys me.
Absolutely, and I've got a couple of friends that do either music with prisoners and... Or I was just talking to a friend the other day who's doing some theatre with prisoners, and the amount of lives that changes because just by having a hobby to focus on or something to focus on. And I think that actually is quite a good segue to Leo's question, because we were kind of getting into that, and Leo was asking what made you have a change of heart about what you were doing. So obviously you were lucky that the book was basically, the documentary will explain it a bit more for anyone, we'll give you the link to that in a minute. But do you think because you walked out into basically a book deal, not immediately, but pretty much a book deal, do you think that that was one of the reasons, or did you already decide in the cells, I'm not doing this ever again? And why was that case? Were you just scared? Were you just fed up, tired of running and lying, basically?
So, I mean, thanks for your question, Leo, mate. I think, to be honest with you, there was a couple of things really that had happened where I felt like, okay, this is not how I want to live my life. One of the things that I remember very vividly was that the last time I was in prison, there were folk who were a bit older than me. Obviously, pretty much everyone was older than me at that point, but older guys who were coming in and out of prison. Yes, and there were some faces that I saw two or three times in my one sentence, in and out. So that, to me, I was like, okay, I just do not want that to be my life. So that was a large part of it as well. But, you know, I have to be totally candid and say that there were times after I came out that, you know, times were tough, and I thought about going back to it, and I knew how easily I would be able to do it again. But fortunately, I never ever went down that avenue, and I had the powers, the right word to use, but something inside me realised that, you know, if I broke that seal again, I might never be able to come back from it.
Great answer. Is Stuart saying, do you miss it at all?
So, Stuart, hi, thanks for your question. Sometimes, 100%, I mean, there's aspects of it that, you know, I wish I could do. Like, for example, when I go away now, I'm not able to check into the absolute top suite in the hotel most of the time. I will be totally honest with you, I had an absolutely incredible experience a few weeks ago. I was down in London, checked into a, you know, relatively modest hotel. We might find that hard to believe, but it is true. When I checked in, so the girl who was checking me in, was filling in the form, and then standing next to her was this kind of quite ominous-looking guy in a black suit that looked very much like hotel security. And he just kept looking at me, and I was like, this doesn't bode well, you know. But anyway, he just looked straight at me, this guy, and he said, are you Elliot Castro? And I said, yes, can I help you? And he says, mate, just wanted to say, saw your show, absolutely amazing. Would you be all right if I gave you an upgrade to your room? And I was like, result. So there's aspects of it, yes. There's things about some of the experiences that I in my life may never ever get a chance to do again. You know, that you think, okay, yeah, I wish I was able to afford that the next room up sort of thing, you know, or if I'm traveling somewhere, then quite often I'm not able to go business or first class or anything like that. So there's aspects of it, but in all honesty, the flip side of that, mate, is that I don't have to look over my shoulder for any case.
And Lou Rogerson asks, if you could go back in time, would you do it all again? Which is a very interesting question.
Not this question. Exactly.
You wouldn't be the person you are. And it's hypothetical.
Do you know what? Right? I totally understand why people ask this question. I think, knowing what I know now, right, which is just, this is an oxymoron, really, because it's never, you can't, you know. But knowing what I know now, would I go back and do it? No, truthfully, I wouldn't. And I think part of the reason for that is because I think one of the things that I've always asked myself is, what could have been if I had went down that path? Like, what would I have done with myself? Because, you know, I think when I was at school, there was a teacher who told me, Elliot Castro, you are either going to be famous or you're going to be infamous. That was, a teacher told me that, and honestly, a few of my teachers were, I won't say the word, this one teacher absolutely nailed it. So would I go back and do it again? With the benefit of hindsight, no, absolutely not.
We've got Smallin10 saying, fascinating story, I watched the BBC documentary too. I'm going to put a link in the description, by the way, for the iPlayer. I'll put it in the comments as well.
Right.
Because if you haven't seen it already, I've missed out a few crucial parts of the story, so there's not too many spoilers. It's still definitely worth watching the documentary. It's really well done. And it's also added, fascinating story, I watched it. If you hadn't got arrested when you did, would you have continued? So suppose, by getting caught, did it stop?
Yeah. Interesting question, and I mean, I think the answer to that one is pretty plain for me to answer now, but I think it took a long time for me to really understand what the hell was going on with me at that time. So things can sort of crash down at the time when I lived in Belfast, I think I'd said earlier on, if you were listening at that time, but that was the first part in time when I had actually felt that I had some real friends around. Absolutely, some of them were fair weather friends, but there were some good people around me at that time, some of who I still keep in touch with now. And what really happened at that time was I had these people around me who were decent folk, who genuinely, if you took all the lies and all the other shit I was up to, if you took that out of the equation, these were still decent folk who I really did have something in common with, aside from all that. And not being able to be yourself ever is a really difficult place to be, because you always have to really think about what you're about to say and make sure that it marries up with the story you've told and all that kind of shit. So I think it was definitely on the way out. If you asked me at the time, then I would have totally denied that and said, nah, this was not my intention. But looking at everything that I was doing at that time, and the fact that I wasn't actually doing my same checks and everything else that I used to do, I think it was only a matter of time, really, before the situation became untenable. Sorry, just one thing is, I'm actually glad it finished when it did, really. And the reason I say that is because no one in their right mind would say that they were glad that they went to jail, but it's not about going to jail, it's about everything that happened as a result of that. I was really forced to think about what the fuck I was doing in my life. And I'm grateful because all of that ended at a time when I was still young enough that I was able to go away and live a decent life. So, you know, in spite of everything that happened, there's so much to be grateful for.
I've put Elliot's Instagram on below, so get Adam on Instagram to hear about all the future stuff. Time for one final question from Ali Grant, who says, I like the way the documentary's facts show rather than sensationalist. There is no bragging, just a real insight. And her question is, have you found the sense of purpose through your new roles that you were searching for when you were a teenager?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's taken me a long time to get here. You know, I completely hold my hands up to that. I mean, I came out of jail for a long time. I wasn't in a normal job, if you like, but I was out DJing every weekend, and that was brilliant, you know. But really, I had a lot of inner shit to deal with, a lot of inner demons, especially about maybe just so much regret for myself in terms of, and I know it's maybe a thing to say I felt sorry for myself, but it wasn't like that. It was just more annoyed at myself because I was always thinking, well, as I said a moment ago, what could have been for me if I hadn't went down that avenue? But you can't live your life like that. You know, you do what you do. You have the experiences you have, and they are what make you the person that you are today. So I cannot allow myself to spend the rest of my life filled with regret about actions that I took when I was a teenager. What I'm really more concerned about with now is, what can I do to help other people? You know, I'm not going to say I'm dedicating my entire life selflessly to helping other people, because I think you also have to look after yourself as well. And if you ain't in a good place, you can't help anyone else. But really what I'm looking at is, like, how can the experiences I've had and the things that I've learned through my life, how can I best put those to use to help other people? The charity that I was talking about earlier on, that was a really sort of breakthrough moment for me, because I had never been put in that kind of position before, that situation, more like, where, you know, I was going in and talking to young people, and with a view to maybe helping them think a little bit differently about where they were headed in their own lives. But the feedback that I got from the coordinator afterwards was absolutely mind-blowing, to be quite honest with you. I was left, you know, nearly in tears with some of the stuff she was telling me. So much so that, you know, they've actually asked me if I want to be on the board of directors for the charity. So that, just to even have that happen as a result of everything, you know, if that's the sort of thing that I'm able to achieve, then I'll be happy with that. And if people think that it maybe somehow makes up for some of the stuff that I've done, then I'll go with that too. But that's not the reason I'm doing it. You know, I'm doing it because I just feel that I really do want to, if possible, try and make a difference to someone else's life. So yeah, we'll see what happens. But thanks for your question.
It's a brilliant question, and I think that's a great way to end the show. We've done just over an hour. If you're listening to this in the audio podcast, remember to check us out on YouTube. If you're on YouTube, remember to check out the audio podcast, Apple, Spotify, and all the usual places. Add Elliot on Instagram. We'll put a link in the description to that. Watch the BBC documentary, Confessions of a Teenage Fraudster, and go and buy the book. It's on all bookstores, but the link that I've put is the one to Amazon, which is called Other People's Money. And Irvin Welsh gave it the thumbs up. Did you speak to Irvin Welsh?
Yeah, I've only met him once. It was actually very fortunate. He was friends with Neil Forsyth, who was involved with him as well. And basically, not friends with him, met him at some luxury event or something like that. So that was how we got that. occasion. He did actually add me on Twitter, so that was a cool thing. Mark, thanks a lot for having me on, mate. Really appreciate that.
It's been great, man. We've actually got a You Call That Radio Night on October the 5th, so if you're available, it'd be great to get you to a wee DJ set as well, man. I'll be in touch with that. I'm going to get myself the book as well, man. I'm looking forward to reading that because I don't know how I missed that. But watch the documentary on iPlayer, Confessions of a Teenage Fraudster. Add them on Instagram and go and watch that documentary on iPlayer if you've not already. Buy the book and cheers, man.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Elliot. And that was Elliot Castro. What a story. And great to hear it. Great to chat to him about it. We'll be back. But remember, we interviewed Saul Davies with James. That'll be on the audio podcast very, very soon. And we've got an amazing guest lined up. A couple of amazing guests lined up for next week on the live stream. If you're watching this on Facebook and Twitch, try and watch it on YouTube because it looks better and it sounds better. And remember to like and subscribe if you are on YouTube already. Great show, one of the best, says Stuart. Ali Grant says, what an incredibly genuine guy to listen to. Really great discussion. I'm glad you enjoyed the show, guys. This is You Call That Radio, and we will hopefully see you very, very soon.
Bye!